Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Dolores Handy. Tonight, we have Boston University's 23rd Great Debate, sponsored by the College of Communications Department of Journalism. Modeled after the Cambridge and Oxford University Union Society's public discussions, the Great Debate brings together alumni, faculty, and students in a lively but collegial forum to discuss current issues in communication and public affairs. Based on the tradition of audience-centered parliamentary debate, it involves a series of speeches alternating for and against the topic, and includes audience participation, as members may comment prior to the panel's rebuttals. The audience then decides the outcome of the debate by voting with their feet and moving to the side of the room representing their decision. Tonight's question is, does affirmative action in higher education really benefit minorities? Introducing our speakers is tonight's moderator, Boston University Journalism Department Chair Robert Zelnick.
Good evening and welcome to the 23rd in the series of great debates. Tonight's question is, does affirmative action in higher education really help minorities? Twice since 1978, the U.S. Supreme Court has held that public universities can lawfully take race into account when making admissions decisions because of a compelling state interest in the educational benefits of diversity. Quotas are forbidden. The mechanism of preference must be narrowly tailored to achieve its goal without compounding the harm to qualified white or Asian American applicants. Of course, minorities are free to shun the elite universities to which some number have been admitted through affirmative action. Some scholars maintain that this relative equality of credentials is likely to be reflected in higher grades and class standing, lower dropout rates. As you'll see very shortly, supporters and opponents of widely practiced admissions policies have very different opinions regarding what the data shows, let alone the desirability of any particular approach. Let me introduce our debaters this evening. First, the affirmative side. They believe and will argue that affirmative action helps minorities. Our lead debater is James E. Coleman, Jr., professor of the practice of law at Duke University. He's a Harvard Law School graduate and for 12 years a partner in a large Washington law firm. He's also well known as a critical student of capital punishment. Dean Provost, one of our two student debaters, is a graduating senior in CAS and the first African-American student to be elected president of the Boston University Student Union. Now, for those supporting the negative side of tonight's question. Richard Sander is a professor of law at UCLA. He's a Harvard graduate and received graduate degrees in economics and law from Northwestern University. His special contribution to tonight's debate is a seminal study of law students published in 2004 by the Stanford Law Review, in which he advances the mismatch theory, which holds that great disparities between the entering credentials of students admitted through affirmative action and others actually hurts the intended beneficiaries. Finally, our student, Joe Morosik. He is a CAS senior and president of the Boston University College Republicans. Last semester, the group created the so-called Caucasian Achievement and Recognition Scholarship, which I'm persuaded was a satirical attempt to highlight the group's opposition to racially based programs. Let me go over the ground rules very briefly. We will lead off with the lead debater on the affirmative side. We'll be followed by the lead debater on the negative side. Then each student, beginning with the affirmative, then we'll have our final presentation by the lead negative debater, followed by the final presentation by the lead affirmative. Then I'll ask you to divide. Those of you who think the affirmative side won will gather and we'll call a winner and loser of the debate. One last rule, this is modeled after the Oxford-Cambridge debate, since we insist that there be no applause during the presentation. I'm ready for our first debater on the affirmative side, and that would be Mr. Coleman. Oh, incidentally, I will ring a bell when the debater has 1 minute left, and then I will ring it again when his time has expired. I would ask you to complete your sentence and retire when you hear the second bell.
Thank you very much for coming out tonight. To the question, does affirmative action in higher education benefit minorities? My unequivocal answer is that not only does it benefit minorities, more importantly, it benefits society generally. As you undoubtedly will hear tonight, the assumption of those who oppose race-conscious admissions to institutions of higher education is that the state ought to be indifferent to whom is admitted to these institutions, beyond ensuring that they are objectively the most highly qualified applicants. Diversity, they will say, at least in our most elite institutions of higher education, is secondary. And if it is not achieved without affirmative action, that is unfortunate, some of them will even say, but in the end, okay. This argument is short-sighted and ignores why the state supports institutions of higher education in the first place. A race-conscious affirmative action admissions policy must be judged against the purpose of public education. The threshold question in this debate then should be, what is the purpose of public higher education? And beyond that, is race consciousness necessary to achieve that purpose? And then only finally, whether those who are admitted under such race-conscious policies are helped or hurt by them. Let me be clear that I will not argue that anti-discrimination is the principal or even a principal justification for race consciousness in higher education admissions. Rather, I will argue that the principal justification for such policies can properly be characterized as diffusion of knowledge, so as to spread, in the words of the Massachusetts Constitution of 1780, the opportunities and advantages of education in the various parts of the country and among the different orders of the people. This diffusion of knowledge is the democratic and overarching purpose of public education at all levels. And by definition, in a multiracial democracy, it requires race consciousness to achieve. Every state has a system of public education, and many of them, not just Massachusetts, explicitly say in their constitutions or education statutes that the purpose of the system is the diffusion of knowledge. The Virginia Constitution, for example, declares that government rests, as does all progress, upon the broadest possible diffusion of knowledge, and that the Commonwealth shall avail itself of those talents which nature has sown so liberally among its people by assuring the opportunity for their fullest development by an effective system of education throughout the Commonwealth. The link between public education and American democracy reflects the original intent of the founders of the country. As envisioned by Jefferson and others in the 18th century, the goal of public education is inclusion through diffusion of knowledge, not exclusivity or concentration of learning. Thus, Benjamin Rush of Pennsylvania observed in 1786 that where learning is confined to a few people, we always find monarchy, aristocracy, and slavery. To achieve the purpose of public education in a democratic society, a principal function of the general plan of government, as Jefferson called it, must be removal of obstacles to the broad diffusion of knowledge. In his time, Jefferson believed that the principal such obstacle was poverty. Consistent with that, he proposed a public education system for Virginia that had as its primary goal education of the poor. Jefferson argued that by eliminating poverty as an obstacle to the diffusion of knowledge, Virginia could claim for its people those talents which nature has sown as liberally among the poor as the rich, but which perish without use if not sought for and cultivated. Race-conscious affirmative action in higher education serves the same function today. Higher education is the portal through which most of our leaders pass at all levels of our society. This essentially is the diversity rationale of affirmative action in higher education, as reflected in Justice O'Connor's opinion in Grutter, the Michigan affirmative action case. Her opinion and its sensitivity to the importance of diversity have roots in our history. In discussing his proposal for a national university, for example, George Washington argued that the more homogeneous our citizens can be made in these particulars, the greater will be our prospects of permanent union. In this sense, diffusion of knowledge seeks to overcome those differences among citizens, such as religion, poverty, race, and national origin, that we wish were irrelevant, but that we know often threatens democratic self-government. The American Revolutionary leaders who believed public education was intrinsically linked to democratic government had in mind a society that was racially homogeneous. As a result, the founders had no occasion to consider the diffusion of knowledge in a multiracial democracy. But by its very nature, diffusion of knowledge in such a society requires affirmative action. The exclusion of African Americans and other minorities from the heady vision of a new world was not inadvertent, but by original design, and continued long after the former slaves formally became citizens. One of the principal characteristics of American slavery was a systematic effort to keep slaves in a state of ignorance. As one defender of this system said, "If you teach the black man how to read, there would be no keeping him. It would forever unfit him to be a slave. He would at once become unmanageable and of no value to his master. As to himself, it would do him no good but a great deal of harm. It would make him discontented and unhappy." What is implicit in that defense of slavery is that education alone had the capacity to end the institution. Following emancipation of slaves, states continued to exclude African Americans and other minorities from their institutions of higher education in order to disenfranchise them and limit their ability to participate in self-government. This was done through policies that directly excluded them by race, as well as policies which had that effect. It has been only in the last quarter century or so that state governments, through race-conscious measures, have made any systematic effort to educate racial minorities to the full extent of their talents and under the same circumstances that white students are educated. That is the goal of diffusion of knowledge, to reach out and educate those whose talents otherwise might not be developed through education at the highest levels and in the most elite institutions that produce our leaders, not just our workers. Diffusion of knowledge through affirmative action, race-conscious and otherwise, is not a remedial device. It is the ultimate goal of public education. A concentration of education among non-minorities undermines that goal, whether or not the concentration results from discrimination. It also subverts democracy, which, after all, was the principal purpose of the discriminatory policies challenged in higher education cases such as Sweatt v. Painter, a case that challenged Texas' attempt to exclude black students from the University of Texas flagship law school. By ignoring the democratic purpose of higher education, the current debate about race-conscious affirmative action wrongly assumes that the issue of who is entitled to higher education is about individual rights. It is not. A race-blind admissions policy in public education would elevate the individual interests of applicants over the fundamentally more important public interests of society in the diffusion of knowledge. In effect, the unstated assumption of those who oppose affirmative action in higher education is that a multiracial democracy can survive with an educational system that might concentrate public education narrowly among non-minorities. They are wrong. Such a race-blind admissions policy directly conflicts with the core purpose of public education. In a society that increasingly is composed of insular, racial, and ethnic groups, such a policy in the long run is self-defeating and undermines self-government. To conclude, as Benjamin Rush said in 1786, where learning is confined to a few people, we always find monarchy, aristocracy, and slavery. To answer the question posed, affirmative action in higher education keeps the descendants of slavery discontented and free. That is its benefit to all minorities.
Thank you very much, Dr. Cohen. The first speaker on the negative side, the lead debater, Richard Sander.
Thank you very much, Dean Zelnick. I think this debate is really about an establishment old guard that's been defending affirmative action for 30 or 40 years, and a new guard that is increasingly saying it's time to look at the results of this experiment and see whether or not they justify the effort that's put into it. So tonight we're focused on affirmative action in higher education. There's affirmative action used in other areas of society. Generally, I don't think we'll be talking about those. We're focused on the use of racial preferences in colleges and universities. And there are a couple of things I think it's important to clarify right at the outset. By affirmative action, I don't think any of us are talking about things like outreach efforts, programs that aim to interest in higher education people who might not otherwise apply. In other words, this is not about expanding the pool of people who are interested in higher education, nor is it about essentially using race as a tiebreaker between two otherwise identical and equally qualified applicants. Affirmative action, as it's used in most realms of higher education today, involves the granting of extremely large preferences. If you try to describe numerical credentials at a typical law school in America on a scale of 0 to 1,000, the band in which most whites admitted to a given law school, the band of the credentials of those students will fall into about a 50-point range, maybe a 75-point range. But the preferences generally extend to blacks at American law schools average about 160 or 170 points. It's huge. It's not anything like a tiebreaker. We're talking about massive preferences, and massive preferences have massive consequences. A second thing that's really important to keep in mind and understand in thinking about affirmative action is that it is not about socioeconomic diversity. It is, despite the comments that Professor Coleman made, it's really not about giving a hand to the disenfranchised. It's, in America today, overwhelmingly just about race. If you look at the areas that I've done research on and that other people have done research on, that is to say, American legal education as a whole, or the most elite institutions of private learning, you find a very consistent picture. About 50% of the students at these schools come from the top 10% of American society. In other words, in the top 10th of the income distribution, the education distribution, the occupational distribution, they have about half the places at these schools. The bottom half of American society gets about 10% of the places. That means that the relative likelihood of being at an elite school or a graduate school is about 25 to 1 if you compare the top 10th with the bottom half. 25 to 1. That's a massive disparity. It's far greater than the disparities anyone's talking about with regard to race. I mean, higher education, the general goal is to try to, specific institutions will try to raise the proportion of minorities from an underrepresentation of, say, 2 to 1 to 1.2 to 1 or something like that. We're not looking at anything like 25 to 1 in the area of race. But that's what we face every day in the area of socioeconomic diversity. That's a huge disparity. You know, it's often thought that what affirmative action is really about is identifying poor students, those from disadvantaged backgrounds, and admitting them. And the notion is that a disproportionate number of those just happen to be black and Hispanic because that's who the disadvantaged in our society is. But that's not how it works. Schools don't take into account socioeconomic disadvantage for the most part when they do admissions programs. They take into account race. And SES differences are viewed as kind of an incidental plus. The reason they do that is because of the credentials gap, the test score gap, the grade gap that exists between blacks, Hispanics on the one hand, and whites and Asians on the other. Every school that admits students that's trying to create diversity is concerned about that credentials gap. They want to make it as small as they can, consistent with their goals of diversity. So they admit the strongest students that they can within each racial group. And that leads effectively to racially segregated admissions. And again, if you look at the analysis that I've done of Michigan's admissions, you can see clearly that's the type of pattern that's going on. Groups are segregated by race and then admitted relative to one another within their own racial group. That has the effect of admitting blacks and Hispanics who are as elite with respect to other blacks and Hispanics as whites are with respect to other whites who get into these schools. So, again, if you just look at African Americans in law schools, you see a 25-to-1 ratio between the representation of those from the top end of the black economic spectrum and those in the bottom half. So it's really a delusion to think that by using affirmative action, we're creating meaningful diversity based on individual opportunity. What we're doing is we're creating a cosmetic sense of diversity. That leads to a related issue, which is, who is really a minority? In the 1960s, when affirmative action programs were started, there was quite a bit of justification because, minorities had not been present in large numbers in institutions of higher education. But now, as these programs are entering their 40th years at many institutions, the character of race in America has undergone a dramatic change. Not only do we have many more minority groups than we had in the 1960s, much more diverse minorities, many types of Hispanics, many types of Asian Americans, and so on, but the black population is increasingly diverse. A recent study by a strong supporter of affirmative action at Harvard Law School found that 70% of the black students in Harvard Law School did not have four grandparents of African-American descent. That is to say, 70% of the blacks in Harvard Law School were either mixed race or they were immigrants, came from the Caribbean or Africa. So how exactly should we define who benefits from affirmative action? I have a multiracial son. His mother is black, I'm white. Should 50-50 be enough to get a racial preference? Well, maybe suppose we draw the line 50-50. Well, if you actually look into my son's background, it turns out that his mother had a white great-grandparent. So he's a little bit below 50%. Does that exclude him from race-conscious admissions? Those are the types of distinctions that we have to essentially decide if we're going to use race, that is, an intrinsic genetic characteristic, to decide who's going to get admitted into universities, who's going to receive these very, very large preferences. So those are just a couple of introductory notes about what's going on with affirmative action, what it consists of. The main thing that I want to talk about tonight is the effects on the intended beneficiaries. Because the central problem that we have when we use large preferences is that those preferences translate into disparities in academic performance. If you give someone a large preference, they're going to be at an academic disadvantage because they're starting out with much weaker credentials. It turns out that things like SAT and high school GPA or the credentials that are used by graduate schools to admit people actually make a difference in performance. So I recently did an analysis of law school performance, and it turns out that half of all the African Americans going to law schools in the United States end up at the end of their first year in the bottom tenth of their class. Let me repeat that. 50% of the blacks in American law schools end up in the bottom tenth of their class. It's very important to understand that low performance is not a function of race. Blacks who enter schools where their credentials are the same as their classmates do just as well as their classmates. So when we talk about the effects of affirmative action, we're essentially talking about choice. We're talking about the choice of admitting students to more elite schools at the trade-off, at the cost of lowering their performance in those schools. That's what all this is about. What makes more sense? To put students in schools where they are similar to their classmates in terms of their credentials, or boost them up to an elite school, and accept lower performance as a cost of that. Now, a priori, it's not obvious whether that's a good policy or not. It might be a good policy. So the research that I've been engaged on, that many of the other people I've mentioned have been engaged on, is about trying to weigh that trade-off and see how it plays out. There are two types of general effects that I want to mention. One is that we can essentially call positional effects. And I think these are very uncontroversial. A positional effect comes from a harm of this mismatch, this being put in an environment with other people with high credentials, just from the fact that you're in a low position in your credentials, that you're going to have low grades. So, for example, Elliot Carter at Dartmouth did some research on the persistence in science of students who receive large preferences. He looked at students, he compared black students who went to different schools and had different levels of mismatch between their credentials and those of their classmates. And what he found was that students who had a large mismatch, in other words, who had gotten the largest preferences, were half as likely to persist in the sciences as students who had not received a preference. Why is that? Well, it's kind of obvious if you think about it. If you go to school and you are, you know, you really want to become a chemist when you grow up, and you start taking chemistry courses, but you've got a tremendous credentials disadvantage vis-a-vis your classmates, and you start doing badly in your classes, you're going to panic. Those hard, you know, curve-graded science classes don't seem like the most hospitable place for you to be. You're going to transfer to another major where the grading's a little bit easier and you can at least finish your degree. It turns out that that has a pretty broad and pervasive effect on the persistence of blacks in science. Another study found it has an equally pervasive effect on the persistence of blacks who want to go into academic careers. There's a tremendous shortage of black PhDs in American society. And a lot of the reason is that when students major in their undergraduate areas of specialty, they have academic trouble. Not because of their race, but because of receiving large preferences. That causes them to do worse, and they start thinking, well, if I'm a C student, it really doesn't make sense for me to think about being a professor someday. I'm not going to pursue a PhD program. So it essentially discourages achievement and causes very, very high attrition. And we end up with a situation with very few black PhDs, and most of those PhDs are in one field, education. I think those effects are fairly uncontroversial. I've seen no published rebuttal or critique of those findings. Maybe we'll hear one tonight, but they're kind of intuitively obvious when you think about them. The second type of mismatch effect that I found a lot in my research has to do with what's actually going on in terms of learning. And essentially, the argument is that if you're in an environment where you're highly mismatched, you're actually going to learn less. The consequence of that, which I've traced in some detail in the legal education context, is that your low grades translate into higher forms of attrition. You graduate at much lower rates, you pass the bar at much lower rates, you get worse jobs when you finish and go into the job market. So this type of learning mismatch dramatically reduces the number of people who end up completing degrees and entering. So much so that there's quite a bit of evidence that the net effects of preferences are actually to lower the number of persons coming out of the programs that we're intending to benefit. If we reduce preferences and students end up going to schools where they face a lower mismatch, they have rates of success that are so much increased that we end up having more members of society who have received that education. To be continued.
Thank you, Richard Sonder. Our next debater on the affirmative side is our student, Dean Provost.
Thank you, Professor Zelnick, and good evening to all. Often people call me Dean Provost in hopes that I'll take over at BU somehow, some capacity as Dean or Provost. But occasionally Professor Zelnick refers to me as Neon Dion affectionately, so I enjoy that as well. Affirmative action in the context we examine today has only been around for approximately 35 years. And it has many interpretations as well as many variations as to how it's been applied. Broadly speaking, the legal characterization of affirmative action is different from the social. From a legal purview, the purpose of affirmative action is not necessarily to compensate for past wrongs, offset unfair advantage, appropriately reward the deserving, or yield a variety of social goods, even though these may be residually accomplished. Rather, its purpose was to change institutions so they could comply with the non-discrimination mandate of the Civil Rights Act. The impetus for altering these structurally poor conditions, however, is socially motivated, and its commitment is to purge the mind of injustice and undue prejudice and discrimination. This is something that we should keep in mind as a characterization. The resolution, as it's read, deals with affirmative action and higher education. But there's a much more profound, latent idea that's there, and that is whatever these benefits that we espouse are they worth the cost? Costs could conceivably fall anywhere along the spectrum that ranges from psychological to structural issues, but all pale in comparison to affirmative action when we look at the reality of the situation. To move away from the philosophical underpinning of the social ideas for why we have these legal mandates, forever dooms America to the ills conversant with racism, prejudice, and discrimination. At the end of the day, it's simply wrong to ignore the racial component in the continued unequal treatment of blacks in America. Race means more than just skin color. It means either privileges and benefits that follow a certain group, and or it means disadvantages and liabilities. Not surprisingly, given what we know about U.S. history, those two things end up being somewhat tied and, in most cases, inextricably correlated. President Johnson, in describing affirmative action, stated, "You do not take a person who has been hobbled by chains, liberate him, and bring him to the starting line of a race and say, you are free to compete with others, and still justly believe you have been completely fair." Thus, it would appear that clear that it's not enough to just open the gates of opportunity, which is what it seems like the opposing side would like to do. Although idealistically this is beneficial, in reality we see that it's much more complicated. Further, even though America has taken this incomplete approach to affirmative action, we do see myriad benefits on our side. Also, it seems cursory to say that, as OPP has done, that 35 years is enough time to gauge properly where America has come in terms of affirmative action, especially considering that we've had hundreds of years of discrimination and racism, segregation, and the gambit of racial injustice. But further, it appears even more cursory and sad to say that if I can't trace my great-grandparents or a few of my grandparents back four generations to have them be, find that they were African-American or of some other racially discriminated minority, that then I am less discriminated against today. We think that the stigma still exists, and this is something that they have to defend on their side to show how, in some way, over the course of time, there has been a lessening of this prejudice and a lessening of this discrimination that has taken place. Justice Thurgood Marshall, after the University of California Regents versus Bakke decision, wrote, "The position of blacks today in America is the tragic but inevitable consequence of centuries of unequal treatment." Marshall wrote in June 1978 that the benchmark of comfort or achievement for meaningful equality in America remains a distant dream. He cited U.S. Census and Labor Department data in seven categories, including the percent of black representation in the five elite professions. Here's what he found, updated with today's standards. In 1978, the life expectancy of a black child was 5 years shorter than that of a white child. Today, it's 6 years. 25 years ago, a black child's mother was three times as likely to die of complications during childbirth as a white mother. Today, it's 3.5 times. The infant mortality rate for blacks was twice that for whites. Today, it's more than twice. In 1978, four times as many black families lived with incomes below the poverty line as whites. Today, the ratio remains unchanged. For black adults, the unemployment rate was twice that of whites. And for black teens, it was three times. Today, both statistics remain unchanged. The median income for the black family in 1978 was 60% of the median income for white families. Today, it's 66%. And similarly, we see gains in professions. But when we look at other categories for whether or not there has been substantive change, we can see that in many ways it falls short for the quality of life issues that we talk about. It's not just about getting a profession. It's not just about PhDs and dentists and doctors and lawyers. It's also about the quality of life that people are able to live. Today, white males comprise 29% of the workforce and 95% of all executive positions. Even though there have been gains, Thurgood Marshall's prophetic statements remain true. Benefits can only be gauged by a cost, and though we're not here to talk about why affirmative action is necessary, a brief commentary is important. We do have affirmative action in other things like farm subsidies, Social Security, etc. We're not going to discuss those today, but the reason why those exist is because our society has determined that there is a larger public good that's essential for accomplishing, and as a result, we think that it's beneficial by having these sorts of programs. Note, Congress has never issued any such decree for racial treatment. The closest thing we've came is to overall treatment with the 14th Amendment, and that's fine. At the same time, there's still progress that needs to be made. Though some argue that race is no longer relevant, we see that relevancy is determined by purpose. And if it's the purpose of anybody in society or any government to say that this thing is beneficial or this thing is not, then we think that it immediately becomes relevant. Similarly, if a nation thinks that it's important to change white institutions so that they're not so uniformly white because it's not reflective of our nation and its skills, then we think that that also makes race important as well. It seems interesting that many, including on the opponent's side, speak of the psychological effects that black people face if they are unprepared or if they question the merits of advancement. Unfortunately, we don't see these same concerns when we talk about the same similar plights. Society at its own peril, would be foolish to expect that those benefiting from the benefits of an inefficient system are going to willfully change those things. It would be the equivalent of having a Wall Street broker make the market efficient so that he couldn't make gains on its inefficiencies. It doesn't make sense. There needs to be, at some point, a correction of these things. And as far as racism goes, this isn't to relegate anyone to any sort of second-class citizenship or anything of that nature. But the main thing that's often not touted enough in our time for why affirmative action is necessary from the perspective of minorities is that it is evidence of the commitment of white people and those who have done wrong, as is often showed in the past, to correctively take care of a measure in the same way that someone who was convicted of a crime and then found to be innocent, the same way we'd pay our tax dollars today for their crime that was done 20 years ago, today we need to pay for what's going to happen in the future for African Americans and people of color and minorities in higher education. Thank you.
I almost tackled you. I've always maintained with pride that we lose very, very little in quality when we go from the lead debaters and to our students, and this presentation was vindication of that. Our student debater on the negative side of tonight's question is Joe Mrosa.
Thank you, Professor. The question, does affirmative action in higher education really benefit minorities, admittedly poses a difficulty for our side of the argument. As the black intellectual Shelby Steele said, how do you say I'm against the policies designed to help you, but I'm not against you? Sure, having special programs specifically designed to help admit more minority students will help them get into college. But the question is whether these programs, while they may help some minorities get into higher education in the short run, are truly beneficial to minorities overall. I argue that race should not be used as a tool in admitting students to a university. To use race belittles the applicant's achievement and even cheapens the educational experience if students are not admitted based on merit, but based on the university's desire to construct a racially diverse campus. Now, proponents of affirmative action say that these programs exist to redress racism that some minorities feel throughout their education and throughout their lives. I do not deny that racism exists in America today, because it does, but race is not the only basis for discrimination today. People are discriminated against for a variety of reasons, from body weight and appearance to religion and political beliefs. Socioeconomic inequity amongst different demographics has existed in this country and undoubtedly will continue to exist. But to try to adjust for racial discrimination by implementing affirmative action policies, which the courts have deemed as an illegal use of affirmative action, does nothing to truly address inequity. Universities send minorities the wrong message about education, essentially saying that they are an asset to the university not because of their academic strengths, but because of the color of their skin. It tells them that their only value is their race. And until affirmative action programs cease to exist, minorities will view themselves as merely a member of a race and not as an individual who is capable of competing with whites on the same playing field. And minorities seem to agree with that sentiment. In a 2001 Zogby poll, 65% of African Americans were found to oppose racial preferences in either hiring or college admissions. 65%. I believe this is because African Americans realize that they can compete with whites and no longer wish to be classified as a race that needs assistance in achieving. They are beginning to bite back on the liberal, multicultural hand that has fed them for decades. Now, of course, there are socioeconomic disparities today, and not everyone goes through life with the same access to opportunity. Now, some of you may be saying, well, that is just what affirmative action is designed to do, to give every individual of every race the same opportunity. However, I argue that equality of opportunity should not be defined by racial admission policies of our nation's universities. Equality of opportunity comes from families, in local school districts, and with teachers. We will see equality of opportunity when all students of all races are able to go through a school system with strong teachers, good reinforcement at home, and schools that can provide the necessary supplies for its students. We should work on improving educational opportunities for low-income families and improving schools in low-income districts, but we should not be adjusting outcomes while turning a blind eye to the true problems of educational inequity, which are financial and not racial. Affirmative action is a cheap way of addressing unequal access to educational opportunity, and the time and effort would be better spent in improving education at the local level. A second reason that proponents of affirmative action often put forth is that it helps to increase diversity on campus. But if we think we need particular members of other racial groups in the classroom, that creates the worst sort of tokenism and belittles the minorities who are admitted for just this purpose. We should not be concerned about whether there is the correct percentage of minorities at our universities, but we should be concerned about a diversity of opinions, a diversity of thoughts, and a diversity of beliefs. There is certainly not much of a diversity of opinions on college campuses today, and as a conservative, I can speak with some authority on that matter. Having a lively debate in the classroom with students from a diversity of opinions serves to educate the student more so than merely being able to sit next to a minority student. Treating minorities as a number, as a percentage, a means with which the university can claim diversity is grossly immoral and is an astounding insult to minorities. So what purpose, then, does one's race serve in the classroom? Is the academic insight that a minority student brings to the classroom contingent solely on the color of that person's skin? Now, sure, diversity of races at a selective institution is valuable, but not forced diversity. We should applaud the achievement of all people in all races, but not blindly worship at the table of forced multiculturalism. Seeing someone as merely a member of a race, as a means to supposedly enhance the reputation of a university, is insulting and it is degrading. We as a society need to question the purpose of forced racial diversity and think about what diversity on a college campus really should mean. A third reason I've heard from proponents is that affirmative action, along with race-based scholarships given out by a university, serve to help minorities that cannot otherwise afford to pay for a university education. Now, I have no problem with programs set aside to help those students who can't afford a university education. But race should not be a factor. Students of all races come from low-income families and should be just as eligible for the same programs. However, as Professor Sanders' studies have found, blacks going into law school receive twice the grant aid that whites from similar socioeconomic status do. A poor black student, though, should be at no greater advantage or disadvantage than a poor white student regarding financial awards. To give a black student specific privileges because of their skin tone is simply wrong. To give someone aid based on their skin color and not on merit or financial need is a gross injustice and has no place at a university. We must shift society's desire for racial diversity in our jobs and in our schools to a desire for the best qualified person for the position. We should stop worshiping racial balance and start praising achievement regardless of race. Racial preferences are not the progressive ideas like their defenders would love to claim. Indeed, they maintain the status quo, not looking forward to end racial divisions in this country, but rather they dwell upon difference and inequity, and at the same time promote difference through the same programs. We are, though, seeing a trend towards ending racial preferences at our universities. They are illegal at public universities in Michigan, California, Florida, and Washington State. People are beginning to realize that these programs are not working and no longer serve a purpose in higher education. It is clear to many that affirmative action cheapens the abilities of minorities, since they are reduced to a member of a race rather than a person with unique credentials and individual stories. Race itself is entirely a social construct, so therefore we as a society must work to destroy racial divisions. But racially based programs like affirmative action do nothing to break down the walls between races. Affirmative action does not benefit minorities as much as it may seem, and it serves no purpose in higher education. Thank you.
Thank you, Joe. Let's conclude the debate now with summations by the two lead debaters. First, arguing the negative side, Professor Rick Sander.
First of all, is there racial injustice? Does race matter in American society? Absolutely. I thoroughly believe that. A lot of my work suggests that housing segregation is a major cause. Housing segregation tends to lead to the concentration of blacks and Hispanics in central city school districts, which are often underfunded and poorly staffed. Areas that have moved towards greater racial integration in parts of the United States have seen substantial narrowings of test score gaps. The test score gap, which is at the heart of the affirmative action and higher education problem, is not a genetic effect. Blacks and Hispanics and whites are not intrinsically different. There are environmental, cultural, educational reasons that cause that gap, and we've got to address those. I'm absolutely committed to that. And maybe what I hear some of you thinking is, well, okay, so maybe affirmative action is not the greatest policy. In fact, maybe it's even counterproductive. But it is a policy. If we get rid of affirmative action, is that just going to increase social complacency? Well, we actually have a way of answering that question. We can look at the natural experiment that's been done in California. California passed Proposition 209 10 years ago, prohibiting the use of race in college admissions, among other things. Now, 209 is not a perfect natural experiment because many of the institutions covered by it have taken various measures to try to evade it. But nonetheless, we can look at that and we can see some things. We can see some effects. And let me tell you what a few of those are. The one that you tend to read about in the papers when 209 is discussed almost invariably is the large drop in black and Hispanic enrollment at the most elite universities in the University of California system. That's Berkeley and UCLA, the place where I teach. And it's true that black and Hispanic enrollments have fallen 50, 60, Some hear 70% from pre-209 days in those campuses. What you don't hear is that overall enrollment at University of California has gone up moderately for blacks, but substantially for Hispanics. That's worth repeating. Overall enrollment at the University of California of minorities is higher now than it was before 209. Why is that? Well, part of it is what I call the cascade effect, which is that if you substantially reduce preferences, then there are fewer minorities at the most elite institutions, but a lot of those minorities end up going to less elite institutions where they're able to get in on their own credentials. That's what you've seen in the UC system. You see some of the schools like Davis and San Diego and Riverside having huge increases in enrollment from students who formerly were going to Berkeley and UCLA. Now, if my argument is correct, then we'd ought to see, as a result of that, better performance at those schools and higher graduation rates. Information is incomplete, but the information we do have is completely consistent with this. UC San Diego has seen a 50% drop in the gap between graduation rates between blacks and whites over the last 10 years. UC Davis has seen a sharp drop in performance differences between blacks and whites at the undergraduate level. So it is having that effect. It's time for us to think about something new. It's time for us to think about phasing out preferences along Justice O'Connor's timeline, forcing universities to say, okay, this is not going to go on forever. We've got to start thinking of alternatives. We've either got to figure out how to raise the performance of the students that we admit, or we've got to come up with better ways of fueling the pipeline, or we've got to think of alternatives of what it means to equalize opportunity in the United States. That's the message that I leave you with. I think that we have to examine affirmative action policies. We've got to come up with, it's time to come up with better alternatives. Thank you.
Thank you, and Professor Coleman, the final speaker of this evening's program.
Well, as I predicted, they didn't say a single word about what the purpose of public education is, although they've done a lot of talk about the failure of affirmative action, but it seems to me very difficult to talk about whether something succeeds without talking about what the purpose or the goal of public education is. Rick just talked about, he says, you know, if you get rid of affirmative action, that's not a recipe for complacency. And he talked about the overall enrollment increase at the University of the California higher education system. And then he sort of slipped in, well, but yeah, it has sort of decreased at the elite institutions. This is nothing more than just a sophisticated, patronizing, separate but equal argument. I've never felt stigmatized by my Harvard degree. It's always been my race. People who know nothing about me and people who know nothing about other black people or brown people or Asians make judgments about them based on their race. So this idea that somehow, you know, we're going to be stigmatized with a Harvard degree because we're black, that's just out of touch with reality. They keep saying that, you know, low grades, this is about low grades and about racial preferences, but it's not about race. And it's not that, you know, racial minorities can't do well, it's that they don't do well. You know, one suggestion is, well, you know, why don't they do well, and why do we have to rely on these policies? And one of the things that they point to, they say, well, it's because of the shameless failure of the society to address the fundamental problem in public education, and that what we ought to be doing, what Harvard and BU and, you know, Stanford and all these other institutions ought to be doing, is devoting more resources to improving the schools. Here's the question: when is that going to happen? Some of the most vocal opponents of affirmative action are the same people who opposed racial integration in the 1950s. But I wonder, why is it that they think that it would be okay to bring in poor people who are not as well prepared as their white counterparts, but not black people who are not as well prepared? Are they going to do better? Rick has the data, so I assume that at some point he'll get around to addressing that. Are poor people or are racial minorities or white students who are poor, who are less prepared because of that, admitted to these elite schools doing better, and will that benefit them? Because if it won't, then why are we going to do that? We ought to say that, look, the elite universities are just for the people who are well-prepared, and if that excludes minorities and that excludes poor white people, well, that's just the way it is. Rather than, you know, engage in this sophisticated argument suggesting that we wouldn't oppose it if it was about socioeconomic status. It seems to me that, again, if Rick is really interested in why people don't succeed in law firms or why they do succeed, he ought to have a standard against which to measure that and not simply make conclusions based on what even he admits is limited data. Thank you.
Okay. We're going to divide up here according to whom you feel won the debate, not necessarily which side you personally support. Those who feel that the affirmative side won the debate, please gather over here to my right. Those who feel that the negative point of view on this proposition won the debate, gather to my left. And I will call the result very quickly. I think the negative side has a few more people on it, so I'm going to call the negative side the winner in this debate, not necessarily the winner on the issue, but the winner of the debate. Thank you.
You've been listening to Boston University's 23rd Great Debate, sponsored by the College of Communications Department of Journalism. Tonight's question was, does affirmative action in higher education really benefit minorities? Arguing in the affirmative was Duke University law professor James Coleman, Jr. and Boston University senior Dion Provost. Arguing in the negative was UCLA law professor Richard Sander and Boston University senior Joe Morosik. Tonight's moderator was Boston University Journalism Department Chair Robert Zelnick. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. CDs are $15, which includes shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Tim Skog, with help from Michelle Tash. Our web producer is Angel Cozzelli. I'm Dolores Handy. Thanks for joining us.